Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line 1, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. As a part of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, today's conversation will be focused on emotional abuse, an aspect of abuse that often goes unseen. While emotional abuse does not leave bruises or broken bones, it can deeply wound a person's confidence, sense of safety, and self-worth. Emotional abuse involves things like manipulation, constant criticism, isolation, threats, and control, which are all tactics used to gain power over another person. Many survivors say the emotional scars, the shame, and the loss of any sense of agency and power are the hardest aspects to heal from. Recognizing the signs of emotional abuse is the first step towards breaking free of the cycle and beginning the process of healing. On today's edition of Line 1, we will be discussing how emotional abuse develops, how to identify it, and most importantly, how to seek help and begin the journey towards healing. Joining me today for today's conversation is Randy Brager, who's the Executive Director of AWAKE. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so let's start off. Randy, why don't you give us a little background on what you've done and what AWAKE is for people who may not be familiar with your organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll actually start with what AWAKE is. So AWAKE, or Abuse Women's Aid in Crisis, is the largest domestic violence safe shelter in Alaska. We have a whole continuum of services, all the way from kind of our typical entry point into services is our emergency shelter, all the way through transitional living programs and ultimately permanent housing. We have a number of other just supportive services, such as legal advocacy. If somebody wants help getting a domestic violence protective order or a stalking protective order, we have education and support groups, and we have a number of services specifically for children. A number of people might not realize that we have all of those other additional services and that you do not have to come stay in our shelter to access those services. A little bit about me. I've only been back at AWAKE for about a year, and I'm thrilled and honored to be back. I actually started my career in human services at AWAKE as a practicum student when I was working on my undergraduate degrees, and just kind of stayed. I ended up being there for about 5.5 years, going through a number of positions, and then really wanted to move to statewide policy and advocacy, thinking I could expand my impact. And so I went and worked for Department of Public Safety and did a number of their specialty programs around domestic violence and sexual assault, including the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, where we were working on policy around all of the backlogged sexual assault kits that had never been tested, and then went back into nonprofit and came full circle.
Okay. Just as a brief side note, if someone is experiencing domestic violence in their home today and they're listening on the show, who can they call? And I'm sure you'll give this information later as well. But what's the phone number if somebody wants to reach out today?
Absolutely. We have a 24/7 crisis line, and that number is 272-0100. It is answered 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And if somebody is not able to call because their calls are being monitored or screened, but they are able to stop by, they're also able to stop by at any time. They do not need an appointment. They can just buzz on our door, and somebody will come up and assist them.
All right, great. Before we get into emotional abuse, I want you just to define, I mean, domestic violence is a big term, right? And it covers a lot of area. And when we think of violence, we don't necessarily think of emotional abuse or name calling or words, right? So what is domestic abuse, and what are the different types of, or could break it down into the different categories, I guess.
Yeah, I look at domestic violence as kind of the umbrella. And so really when you're talking about domestic violence, there is the dynamics within intimate partner violence, which may present a little bit differently than across other types of relationships, such as within family members, you know, mother, son, you know, aunt, uncle, kind of all of those relationships that are also still defined, especially by law. And that is kind of the other umbrella I break down is the kind of philosophical public health definition is very different than the legal definition. It's really hard to capture the nuances in human relationship and boil that down to a set of laws that law enforcement can enforce. And so really, today, I know we're going to be focusing on kind of that intimate partner violence. And really that is the systems and behaviors that someone will exert over one person in the relationship in order to maintain that power and control. And you did a very good definition of emotional abuse that really translates to kind of the entirety of the dynamics that we see.
Yeah, I heard somewhere, and I've quoted this, so I just wanted to check with you to see if it's accurate, but that the most dangerous thing a woman can do in the United States is to get married.
The statistics are not in your favor. So domestic violence ends up being one of the leading causes of death, depending on the year and the stat you look at. And the other most dangerous thing a woman can do in a domestic violence relationship is try to leave.
Yeah.
And so I know we'll talk about later around all the reasons why someone doesn't leave, but it is really important for family and friends and the general community to understand that the lethality escalates significantly once the person tries to end that relationship. And that is because that power and control is being taken away from the perpetrator of the violence.
Right. And the perpetrator becomes afraid, really, mm-hmm. the underlying, underneath the anger is fear, right, mm-hmm. of being alone, of being left, of not having that power and control. Mm-hmm. Okay. So today we're going to focus a lot on emotional abuse. And I think, I mean, the violence part is, I think, easier for everyone to understand, right? Mm-hmm. There's bruises, there's broken bones. People die from mm-hmm. it. And so that one's pretty clear. Emotional abuse is often, you know, can happen friendships, at work, like you mentioned, lots of different arenas. So, but today we're going to be looking at intimate relationships, partner relationships, and how emotional abuse shows up, how to recognize it, and how to get help for it. So can you start us off with a sort of a definition of emotional abuse? What is it? What qualifies?
Mm-hmm. Really, it's defined in so many different ways, and it is largely within the context of the relationship. It's what tactics work, right? And so I look at as emotional abuse as a series of behaviors and tactics with the aim of slowly eroding a person for who they are as a person. You had mentioned the, you know, impacts on self-esteem with the constant criticisms or insults. It can be around isolation, slowly isolating that person away from all of the rest of their support network. It can look like a combination of financial abuse too, withdrawing or withholding financial access to buy groceries or drive their own vehicle, have their own jobs. There's also a component of, you know, cultural and spiritual elements, depending on the person's background and how that might be used to control them by speaking to kind of their religious beliefs and things like that.
All right. And, you know, it can often be very subtle. You mentioned financial abuse. That's kind of a strange term that most people haven't heard of, but you talked about the withholding of money, not letting someone have a credit card or a debit card and really controlling the finances. But what are some other subtle ways that emotional abuse can show up in relationships that somebody might not recognize?
Mm-hmm. Well, especially around the not recognizing, gaslighting is something that is very typical in terms of emotional abuse. And that really is a combination of behaviors that make people question their perception of reality. That could be anywhere from that never happened, or you're exaggerating, or you started it, you know, all of that.
You're too sensitive.
Yep, you're too sensitive. I didn't mean it that way. I was joking. And so it can be a lot of those subtle behaviors that make people question themselves. Emotional abuse tends to happen earlier on in the relationship because I've said this before a number of times, but if you were assaulted on your first date, you probably wouldn't go on a second date with them.
Right.
And so that tends to be earlier on in the relationship, and then as necessary, just to maintain power and control. And so physical violence doesn't happen the most often in these relationships. And so in between explosions and assaults, you'll see the days, weeks, months, or years of the emotional abuse. That starts off a lot more subtle. One of the things I tell family members and friends to keep a lookout for is a slow erosion and challenging of boundaries. It starts off very, very subtly in that way. That might look like someone trying to set boundaries around their time, time of day for phone calls because they have to go to work or things like that. And that slow kind of pushing of those boundaries really allows the person to kind of figure out like how much they can get away with.
All right. For those of you who might just be tuning in, my guest today is Randy Brager, who is the executive director of Awake. Today's conversation is focused on emotional abuse, how it develops, how to identify it, and how to break free of the cycle. Okay. You mentioned, I have to excuse my voice today. I think I'm losing my voice. If we have the slow erosion, right, and it's kind of like the frog in the pot, right? Mm-hmm. It slowly over time, it gets hotter and hotter. So starting out is rarely violent. But then as you move further into the relationship, like, is there a timeline? How quickly does it start happening? What are some of the early signs that somebody should watch out for? Like in the, you know, weeks, months, the first relationship is starting that people often think that's a red flag. I mean, red flags don't mean it's a carnival, right? Mm-hmm. It means go away. Mm-hmm. So what are some of those early signs that somebody might just blow off?
Mm-hmm. I think very typical in our culture is the joking and the insults, right? And a lot of it is presented as a joke, but really it is about starting to establish the hierarchy and the relationship and impact people's self-esteem. And so it might be really subtle comments about the way someone wears their clothes or how they interact with friends or strangers, all the way up to name calling, you know, and then blaming for whatever kind of conflict that exists between the two of them. That is one of the more typical things. The other component I like to speak about in terms of emotional abuses is the love bombing aspect. And so another red flag is someone who pushes to hit relationship milestones very quickly. Again, if it's low risk, right? You guys are just dating, you're hanging out a little while, that's, you're not going to have a lot of control in that. But if you can push that person quickly to maybe move in, to get married, to have a child, to adopt a pet, to share bills, then that links someone in a lot more closely, a lot more quickly. And that's not to say all of the couples out there that got married a couple weeks in that was a bad thing. I'm right. Just saying a combination of that type of behavior with some of the other red flags should make someone pause. The other big one that we see that, it, again, can be really subtle is the isolation factor. And I say subtle because it might not be someone outwardly saying, you're not allowed to hang out with this person, or your mom doesn't like me, so I don't want you going over there for dinner.
Right.
it might look like starting an argument or a fight every time she does go out. And then she starts self-selecting in order to avoid the conflict, the argument, the blow up. It might be that she starts making excuses with family and friends to not go out and do those things. And so that isolation becomes a really key factor in this type of relationship continuing in that silence.
Now, today we're just the language that we use is important. And I was thinking we're talking about she, right? Mm-hmm. And what are the percentages of men that you see that come in seeking help for domestic violence? Or, and maybe this is a whole nother topic because the numbers are skewed heavily that women are often the victims. But in emotional abuse, I mean, are the numbers the same or are they different? And men can be in relationships that are emotionally abusive or where they're the victim.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you asked because I think it's a really important part of the conversation. So it depends on the behaviors you're looking at and how you're defining domestic violence. One of the ways that I look at domestic violence is the end of the relationship and homicide rates. So if you were just looking at emotional abuse or maybe the pushing or the slapping, you'll see that the statistics are pretty even, right? And that's often with how we ask the question, though. I'll be honest. If you ask a question around, has your partner ever pushed you, called you a name, slapped you, withheld something from you, the answer is going to be pretty even because there's often a lot of unhealthy dynamics back and forth in relationships like this. What I point out to people and the reason why I say she often when we're talking about domestic violence is because the statistics don't continue in that even pattern once you get up to domestic violence homicide. The majority of all homicides women are victims of is within a domestic violence context, and that statistic just does not hold true for males. Typically, it is either a stranger relationship, acquaintance, or kind of friend aspect, or inner circle aspect. It is not very often a domestic violence context.
There's not a lot of battered men.
Yeah, I think that there absolutely can be men who are victims of domestic violence, and that is also why we serve all victims. And so our name is a little bit of a misnomer.
Right.
It's the product of the movement that came about in the 70s and 80s where we were absolutely creating safe shelters for women. And now as we understand the dynamics a lot more and we can see that there's a large variety of people that need assistance, we offer equal services to all. The numbers are a lot lower for us, and that could be for a number of reasons. It could be often that male victims tend to have more resources still at their disposal, and so they might not necessarily need an emergency shelter type aspect. But it also is absolutely cultural, where it is less socially acceptable still for males to talk about their victimization in that way.
Yeah, I was thinking the shame and the stigma of that with men is a big barrier. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, before we go on, I just want to, we're at our first 20-minute break, so we'll go ahead and take a break here. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Randy Brager. She is the executive director of Awake. Today's conversation is focused on emotional abuse, how it develops, how to identify it, and how to break free of the cycle. After a short break, we'll return for more of our conversation about emotional abuse. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. For those of you who are just tuning in, my guest today is Randy Brager, Executive Director of the Awake Shelter. Today's conversation is focused on emotional abuse, how it develops, how to identify it, and how to break free of the cycle. Okay, I got a few emails here that I want to get to. Hello, listening to your show in Homer, people are listening from all around the state. Please bring up the fact that Awake is one of maybe 17-ish agencies in the Alaska Network of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Also, my question would be, how has all the recent cutbacks of money impacted these nonprofit agencies? Thanks for the program, Donna. Thank you for bringing that up. That's a great point. We're in Anchorage, but this is, what if somebody's in rural Alaska and needs, what other agencies? You said you gave a phone number, but is that statewide? What about rural Alaska?
No, great question. I'm glad that got brought up. As the listener had mentioned, we are a part of a network, the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And across the state, there are programs doing the same work for their community that Awake does for Anchorage and for statewide. So largely it is around a hub and spoke model, fortunately or unfortunately, in terms of resources. And so many of the hub communities around the state also have services available. That phone number is Awake's crisis line. Okay. We are one of a handful of programs that are staffed, rather with paid staff rather than volunteers, that operate a full 24-hour crisis line. And also being in Anchorage, we end up kind of being the epicenter of a lot of services because the services in other communities are less. It's harder to get therapists or drug treatment counselors and things out throughout the state. And so you'll often have people come from all different communities and come into Anchorage. But if somebody is listening and they need help, absolutely. And you can go to the ANDVSA website, so andvsa.org, and look up what program serves your kind of home community. Unfortunately, there's not a statewide phone number for that. Each program has their own phone number, but a good starting point for a lot of different resources would be 211, which is the Alaska 211 line run by United Way that tries to keep updated on available resources in the state.
And they can kind of point you
yep.
in the right direction from there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you for that email, Donna. That was the other part of it, how's the federal funding? Like, what have you seen? I think that's important in the shutdown days. What's the federal funding looking like for y'all?
I think all of the programs right now are struggling and are nervous about the impact of the funding. And so slowly, those funds dedicated through the Violence Against Women Act have decreased steadily over the years. Every one of the programs statewide has been flat funded through those federal funds that are passed through the State Department of Public Safety. And really what we know of flat funding over that span of time is that is a cut. Costs
yes.
continue to increase, and if you are getting flat funded, then you're not able to keep up with those costs. Additionally, I know a lot of programs have lost funding that was available that simply got pulled and not reinstated. And so I know for my program specifically, we lost about $400,000 last year in federal funding, and we're really unsure what that's going to look like this year, because on the federal fiscal year, the government shut down at the start of their fiscal year. And so hopefully when they open, we'll know a little bit more about what the landscape looks like. But a lot of programs are bracing themselves. And in Anchorage, we're a little more fortunate because our funding is a little more diversified. There are programs around the state, if that primary funding source is reduced, their doors will shut.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, David sent an email, the moderator made the observation to the effect the most dangerous thing a woman can do in the United States is get married. In my professional experience and in my reading as a now retired primary care physician who practiced for 46 years in Alaska, I believe that living together while unmarried is even more dangerous. Are there statistics on married versus domestic partnerships where there isn't marriage?
There may be, but I really can't speak to that with any authority. I have not read the research around that particular area one way or another. I would say that it's take it back down to, you know, sociology, quite honestly. I think that when you are unmarried, there is a little bit easier ability to detach from a relationship than adding marriage, especially with kids, as an additional complicating component. But I honor what that person is observing in their own practice.
Well, I'm also thinking people may tend to move in with people quicker than if you get married, that may be further down the line.
Yeah, maybe. Well, and I imagine that it's also more closely connected to socioeconomic impact and status. The reality is Alaska in Anchorage is very expensive to live in. You have professionals that have, you know, steady jobs that are having to roommate up, you know, because they can't afford the cost of living. And so when you have people that move in together out of necessity and push that line in their relationship a little more quickly for that, then yeah, you can have a lot of all the same dynamics happening.
All right. Another email. Please do not neglect addressing elder abuse by caregivers, living relatives, and economic abuse. We've touched on financial abuse, which is economic abuse, but and also remember that abuse is often a two-way street.
No, I think it's a really good point to bring up elder abuse, especially since 10 to 15% of the people that are in our shelter at any given time are elders. I put that in a twofold category because we're talking about intimate partner violence. That doesn't necessarily address all of the dynamics that the listener is probably also addressing with the abuse within the caregiver relationship, which could be siblings, it could be children, and that absolutely complicates those things. Within a intimate partner context, it's easy to trace the line, right? If it started as an abusive relationship, that abuse tends to not decrease or eliminate without some sort of intervention. And so if a couple has been together for 40 years and domestic violence has been a part of it, then just because the victim and or perpetrator got older doesn't mean that abuse has stopped.
Okay. Another email, which I think is a good question. Hi, thanks for considering my question. If my question is, as someone who refers clients and patients to your services often, I know you are frequently full. Can you talk about that problem and what that means? Is it a physical space issue, staffing issue, funding, or something else? And what would allow you to expand? And the second part is, if you are full and there's someone seeking a shelter after DV, what are other options? This person says, I understand there are no other secure shelters. What's the next best non-secure option for folks?
Now, that's an incredibly important question, especially in a state that tends to run amongst the top in the nation for domestic violence and for specifically for domestic violence homicide. We have 67 beds, and that is not near enough to serve the community. And so, unfortunately, we do have to turn people away at times. If someone showed up at 3 a.m. and had just gotten assaulted, then if they're going to sleep on the couch, we'll put them on the couch.
Okay.
I started my career as an advocate, and I had many of nights where we had blow-up mattresses, we had people sleeping on the couches, because if we turned that person away, there was a good chance that they were going to be significantly hurt or killed. Unfortunately, there's not another domestic violence shelter in Anchorage. And so if that person needs the secure facility to keep themselves safe, we are the option. We can absolutely talk about other resources with that person, whether that is a protective order, whether that is coordinating with law enforcement. There are a number of other shelters in the city. We partner quite frequently with Clare House, that is run through Catholic Social Services. And more we are seeing housing being developed specifically for victims of domestic violence. And so one of those programs that just got launched is actually through NeighborWorks Alaska. RuralCap also has some funding. And so it might not look like coming into shelter. It might look like safety planning until we can get them connected with specialized housing.
Okay, so there's no great options beyond you for secure.
No. For a lockdown facility.
How often are y'all at capacity?
Most of the time. Our staff is really good at kind of triaging. And so often when people are brought into shelter, we start exploring what resources might be available to them. That might look like flying them out of state to reconnect them with their family and friends and their support network, or to back to their home community if they're in the state. It might look like evaluating kind of the context and details of that specific relationship and transitioning them to a different shelter, because that person could be safer at that shelter, to free up kind of that bed space.
Okay, let's excuse me, get back into some of the emotional abuse sort of challenges. What are some of the emotional or psychological effects that a person experiences when they're living under that kind of control?
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing is they start to believe everything that is being said to them. They start to believe that they deserve to be treated this way. You gave a fantastic introduction to the episode, and one that has been, I have heard many, many times from the people I've worked with, is the emotional abuse is the hardest part to get over. It takes years and years sometimes, often with outside interventions such as meeting with, you know, a counselor, to really start to undo the messages that they really incorporated into part of who they are, whether it's that they're stupid, whether it's they're deserving of the violence that they're being victimized with, whether they start to believe they are not going to get anything better, you know, on and on and on. They really incorporate those messages into who they are.
It's kind of like being brainwashed or a cult mm-hmm. sort of mm-hmm. situation.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say? Like, it's easy to tell somebody, just leave.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody's been treating you like crap for, you know, 15, 20 years, what do you say to that comment? Just leave.
I will say that the interactions in these intimate relationships are so complex and nuanced that those asking someone why they don't just leave is actually not really helpful. It's pretty damaging and creates a lot of shame and self-blame. And so really, I try to get people, even if they don't understand all the complexities of domestic violence, I just try to get them to understand it from a practical standpoint. Again, we live in a city that most people cannot live independently in. And so when you have children, when you have a roof over your head, when you have transportation options, asking someone to leave the relationship and potentially leave every bit of that safety net along with it is sometimes impossible, if not just impractical.
Yeah, I mean, and I say women because I work with a lot of women who've been involved in mm-hmm. domestically violent relationships, be it emotional abuse or physical, usually emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really fearful mm-hmm. for people to leave what you've known. Oftentimes you don't have the resources, like you mentioned, and It's scary. Mm-hmm. And the fear of being alone. Mm-hmm. You may have kids. You don't want to split up the family. It's not that bad, air quotes.
Or they really do love me.
They really do love me.
That's an aspect that I think is difficult for people to understand from the outside looking in, is this is still a relationship that person is engaging in. There might even be moments where, you know, they see the glimmer of what the relationship started as. And so that's the other bit of advice I give people, is focusing less on the labels of it, trying to convince someone that they're a victim and that person whom they love and are in a relationship with is a perpetrator or abuser or whatever other kind of heavy word we assign to it, because that will often cause people to isolate even more.
Yeah, when I work with couples in these sorts of relationships, and when we actually call it abuse, you can see the discomfort from both, really, when we're talking about behaviors. Like, that's emotionally abusive. Mm-hmm. And people don't like to think of themselves as being abusive or being the victim of an abusive person. So it's interesting. The language is important. So this email just sort of plays into what you're talking about. Just a thought: when you see someone or know someone who is in an abusive relationship, one small thing you can do is say something nice to them, like, your hair looks nice today, or I really like your jacket. This can leave them a moment of someone behaving towards them with kindness and something to remind them that they are worthy of kindness and praise. You can often see the gratitude in their eyes.
Oh, that's beautiful and absolutely true. One of the PSAs we are actually running right now for Domestic Violence Awareness Month is about how family, friends, or even bystanders can support victims of domestic violence. And that is a great example. And it really comes down to listening without judgment, and listening without insisting on labels or setting ultimatums with your relationship with that person.
That's like, not if you don't leave him, I can't be friends with you.
Exactly. Because that isolation is already a key aspect. That's not saying that somebody shouldn't set up their own boundaries to keep themselves safe, because domestic violence often doesn't just impact that person in the relationship. There are very real concerns for kind of the family and friends surrounding them. And so I'm not saying don't set boundaries, but that ultimatum aspect, which we see time and time again, really is just putting more control in the hands of the abusive partner.
Okay, well, we're going to come back. And when we come back from the break, I'd like to talk about what people can do if they're in it and they want to get out, or if you know, you have a friend or a family member and you want to know what's the best way to talk to them about it or approach them. So we'll jump into that after the break. So for those of you who are just tuning in, my guest today is Randy Brager, who's the executive director of Awake. Today's conversation is focused on emotional abuse, how it develops, how to identify it, and how to break free of the cycle. After this short break, we will continue with more of our conversation with Randy Brager. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in late, my guest today is Randy Brager, who is the executive director of Awake. Today's conversation is focused on emotional abuse, how it develops, how to identify it, and how to break free of the cycle. Okay, before we get into how to support people, how to help people, how to talk to people who are involved in this, I do want to read one more email from a caller who didn't want to go on the air, but the question is, they discussed the childhood environment where their family said and did things to emotionally hurt them. So growing up in an abusive home, and that led them to entering adulthood believing those things, which led to them getting involved in abusive relationships. Oftentimes, you see people who had parents who were in a domestically violent relationship, and they find themselves, against all logic and reason, mm-hmm. you think, wow, if you saw that growing up, you're going to run away from it. But that's not the case necessarily, right?
Mm-hmm. No, and that's a really important observation. Another complexity of domestic violence is that it is often intergenerational, and as much as research debates what the cause of domestic violence is, you know, one of the highest correlating factors is learned behavior. You'll often see kids when they see their parents smoking or drinking. You know, they might either go far over one end, and I'm never picking up a cigarette in my life because I remember it was stinky, it costs a lot, right. All those things. But then you have some people that were around it every day, and so it became a natural habit that they just picked up, and it was supported and or encouraged in some way within their family, or they got some other, you know, benefit from it. And so, yes. And when we're talking about victims and perpetrators of domestic violence, quite honestly, you are talking about such a long history of complex and compounded trauma. Yeah. It's very rarely just this one thing. That's why it's really important for people to understand in a general sense, you know, the concept of adverse childhood experiences and how that might increase your risk factors for not only domestic violence, but other health implications.
Adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, mm-hmm. right, as they're known. And the correlation line between adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and mental health problems, dysfunctional relationships, there's a direct correlation. The mm-hmm. more ACEs you have in your childhood, the more likely you are to be involved in addiction or violence or some other form of dysfunction. So that was a great email. Thank you for that question. All right, going into, you got a sister, you got a best friend, somebody who's involved, who you really are worried about, and mm-hmm. maybe it's not violence, maybe it's just meanness and mm-hmm. and ugliness. And how do you talk to somebody about that if you're concerned about it, or if a friend comes to you and says, what do I do?
Mm-hmm. I think the key part is keeping the communication lines open, like we were talking about earlier, with a combination of validation of what you're observing and what you feel the person might be going through, but also not putting conditions around that support and that additional judgment or shaming around it. One of the ways that we kind of talk to family and friends is ask questions, approach it with curiosity, ask that person how they're feeling in that relationship. Are they feeling safe? What kind of support do they want and need? And then decide what you can do safely, not only physically safely, but psychologically, because it's yeah. also very emotionally tiresome and draining to be that supportive person. And that might look like anywhere from call me day or night, you know, I will always pick up and we can talk about it, to if you ever need to leave for any reason, show up at my door, right? And everything kind of in between. It really is identifying like what you can do, and some of that emotional support is one of the biggest things, and saying nice things. I love what that listener wrote. And the other piece is refer to resources. It's really hard to be that close to someone and be in the best position to kind of help and guide. That complicates relationships pretty quickly. I even would say that about, you know, siblings and things like that. You don't want to be the doctor and the support person in that situation. And so allow programs like Awake or other programs to provide that kind of support piece, and refer them to resources.
And I think it's also important to remember, as somebody who cares about someone who's in one of those, is that it often takes people a long time to leave, and they'll make statements like, that's it, I'm done, I'm out, he's never going to talk to me that way again. But don't, I mean, if you hold them to that, then you're going to and start cutting off that relationship because they're not following through. It takes many, many attempts.
Oh, absolutely. And that's, we typically kind of give that statistic of it takes 7 to 10 times of those attempts to finally permanently disengage in that relationship. And again, that's easy for us to say, right? But as soon as you add in a complicating factor such as children, the reality is that person is going to be connected to their abusive partner for the rest of the time that child is under the age of 18. And so it's really important for us not to treat something that is very gray as a black and white issue for that person.
Okay, I have a phone call I want to get to. Amanda, you are on line one. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I escaped domestic violence. I didn't want to leave because I didn't want to leave my kids behind. So sorry for the emotion. And so I had to strategize, and I needed a support network that I found online. I found resources on one mom's battle online and Lindy Bancroft books that helped me to realize I wasn't alone and there were other women that were going through it, and to understand why he was acting that way. And I had to protect my child, so I had to get a mini storage unit and remove things and put things in their place so that he wouldn't notice things were gone. And then when I got out, I didn't get a lot of support from attorneys because they didn't understand what it was to be a victim. So I found resources with other survivors and then sent help to other women who were trying to escape, because I'm one that understands when an attorney doesn't. And so it really does. I don't want to discourage people, but you need to find support people who've been through it and who can help you. And I think that shelters and things are wonderful places because they have people that are like that, that can help women who are in a dissociated state or who want to believe that they love him or that he won't do it again, he promised, right? But really, a lot of women don't leave because they don't want their kids or their pets to be hurt. And so, I thank you for this show. And please tell the women to check out One Mom's Battle and Lindy Bancroft books. Those are very helpful places to start.
Amanda, thank you for the call. That's exactly why we're doing this program, right?
Thank you so much for sharing. I know that is incredibly difficult in its own right, and I appreciate when survivors are willing to tell their stories because it reminds the rest of us that are listening that we are not alone in this situation. And I also appreciate that you bring up the importance of survivors helping survivors, because really much of the work that we do is based around that concept. The only reason why these shelters exist, these laws, these protections, all of those things that did not exist only 30, 40 years ago, was because of survivors banding together and really advocating for those things. And it's something that we really still honor in the work that we do. Many of my team members that work at my program are also survivors, including myself. And so not that that makes you an expert in everybody's situation, but it really does make you evaluate how you serve from a different perspective.
Yeah, there is something about that shared experience that is powerful and healing, right? All right, thank you, Amanda. That's I think that phone call really illustrates the challenges around leaving. She talked about staging the house, about having to replace things and slowly. And can you talk about the importance of a plan when you're leaving one of these situations. I think that Amanda's phone call triggered that for me is something that's important to talk about.
Absolutely. That is one of the services that we provide, is something called safety planning, because we know, just as we talked about earlier in the show, that that point of leaving or preparing to leave is the most dangerous time for a person, and they know their situation the best. And so when we sit down with somebody, we go through all of those different kind of planning aspects. And children and pets are a very real barrier. I often say that children and pets are the primary reason why someone stays, but they're also the primary reason why people eventually choose to leave. I also want to take note of the pets, because most people know that you can bring your children in shelter, but we also have a safe haven program for pets.
Okay.
Yep. And so if someone needs to leave in the middle of the night, you know, they can bring their animal, and we actually have volunteer foster families run through a rescue here in town that will provide temporary foster care until that person can leave shelter and go to a different area. And so your animal will be safe, they'll be taken care of, and they'll be returned to you when you are ready.
Okay. Emotional abuse, and if we're getting back to that topic, leaving those sorts of relationships is often harder than the physical abuse. I've had women that I've worked with have been married, and they say, oh, if he ever hit me, I'd be done. Mm-hmm. And when I'm asking, why do you put up with him calling you names and controlling everything? Well, he's never hit me. That's when I hear a lot. So emotionally abusive. And can you talk about the cycle of abuse and how that, like when women get, or men get close to leaving, the perpetrator change tactics?
And I think what you just said is really important. Domestic violence is not a single action. It is a series of approaches and tactics to still have the same outcome, which is, again, maintain control over somebody in the relationship. And so that cycle, and that's what it is continuous. When I mentioned that the relationship is not always bad, that is very real hook for people staying in those relationships. And so we kind of describe it as a very oversimplified cycle, if you will. But that might be where things are going really well, right? We call that the honeymoon phase. And then you move into kind of that tension building where, you know, they might start calling you names more often. They might start blocking you from leaving a room and things like that. But you can feel it, right? You can feel it in your body that something's coming. And that's where a lot of times you'll have victims either walk on eggshells or, and this is counterintuitive, try to control when that next phase happens, which we call the explosion phase. And a lot of people don't think about that until I give them some scenarios. So, for example, if you have children and you feel that tension building up, that might look like her starting that fight, physical or you know, really verbal and emotional abusive argument, when that child's at a sleepover or when that child's at school. And things like that. And so we see that time and time again where victims actually try to control when that explosion is going to occur to minimize the impact for other people involved or to minimize the impact to themselves.
A question I often ask, particularly women who have daughters or sisters, I say, if your daughter was in this kind of relationship, what would you tell them? 100% of the time they say, I would tell them to leave. So it's pretty clear. It's easy to see it in someone else, but when we are living it, if a person is living it themselves, it's, I can handle it, or I can manage it, or yeah, he's really sorry. That cycle of, a lot of times people will be on their best behavior after a big blow up, right? Or when a woman is threatening to leave, really threatening to leave, there'll be a period of stability.
That's where the love bombing kind of comes back in. Absolutely. And it's really important for people to understand kind of the risk factors associated with their situation. The other thing that our staff are trained to do is something called a danger assessment. So as part of their safety planning, we go through a validated tool to kind of ask them really pointed, detailed questions about their relationship to kind of help them understand where they are at in that lethality scale.
Okay, I wish we had another hour because I think there's a lot that we didn't get to cover, but it's been really a great conversation. What's your take-home point? You got about 30 seconds.
Anytime you need help or you have someone that needs help, call our crisis line, 272-0100.
All right. I really do appreciate you, Randy, for taking the time to join us today. This was an important conversation. I also want to thank my producer today, Madeline Rose, and today's audio engineer, Chris Hyde. For all of us at Line One, we appreciate you taking the time to share a little bit of your day with us. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.